An Abundance of Catherines by John Green. To my wife, Sarah Urist Green. Anagrammatically, her great Russian grin has treasure. A great risen rush. She is a rut ranger. Anguish arrester. Sister haranguer. Treasure sharing. Heart reassuring. Signature sharer. Erasing rare hurts. But the pleasure isn't owning the person. The pleasure is this: having another contender in the room with you. Philip Roth, The Human Stain. Chapter 1. The morning after noted child prodigy Colin Singleton graduated from high school and got dumped for the 19th time by a girl named Catherine, he took a bath. Colin had always preferred baths. One of his general policies in life was never to do anything standing up that could just as easily be done lying down. He climbed into the tub as soon as the water got hot, and he sat and watched with a curiously blank look on his face as the water overtook him. The water inched up his legs, which were crossed and folded into the tub. He did recognize, albeit faintly, that he was too long and too big for this bathtub. He looked like a mostly grown person playing at being a kid. As the water began to splash over his skinny but unmuscled stomach, he thought of Archimedes. When Colin was about 4, he read a book about Archimedes, the Greek philosopher, who'd discovered that volume could be measured by water displacement when he sat down in the bathtub. Upon making this discovery, Archimedes supposedly shouted, "Eureka," which is Greek for "I have found it," and then ran naked through the streets. The book said that many important discoveries contained a Eureka moment. And even then, Colin very much wanted to have some important discoveries, so he asked his mom about it when she got home that evening.
"Mommy, am I ever going to have a Eureka moment?"
"Oh, sweetie," she said, taking his hand, "what's wrong?"
"I want to have a Eureka moment," he said,
the way another kid might have expressed longing for a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle. She pressed the back of her hand to his cheek and smiled, her face so close to his that he could smell coffee and makeup.
"Of course, Colin, baby. Of course you will.
But mothers lie. It's in the job description." Colin took a deep breath and slid down, immersing his head. "I am crying," he thought, opening his eyes to stare through the soapy, stinging water. "I feel like crying, so I must be crying. But it's impossible to tell because I'm underwater." But he wasn't crying. Curiously, he felt too depressed to cry, too hurt. It felt as if she'd taken the part of him that cried. He opened the drain in the tub, stood up, toweled off, and got dressed. When he exited the bathroom, his parents were sitting together on his bed. It was never a good sign when both his parents were in his room at the same time. Over the years, it had meant, 1, your grandmother slash grandfather slash Aunt Susie, whom you never met but trust me she was nice and it's a shame, is dead. 2, you're letting a girl named Catherine distract you from your studies. 3, babies are made through an act that you will eventually find intriguing but for right now will just sort of horrify you. And also, sometimes people do stuff that involves baby-making parts that does not actually involve making babies, like, for instance, kiss each other in places that are not on the face. It never meant 4. A girl named Catherine called while you were in the bathtub. She's sorry. She still loves you and has made a terrible mistake and is waiting for you downstairs. But even so, Colin couldn't help but hope that his parents were in the room to provide news of the number 4 variety. He was a generally pessimistic person, but he seemed to make an exception for Catherine's. He always felt they would come back to him. The feeling of loving her and being loved by her welled up in him, and he could taste the adrenaline in the back of his throat, and maybe it wasn't over, and maybe he could feel her hand in his again and hear her loud, brash voice contort itself into a whisper to say, "I love you," in the very quick and quiet way that she had always said it. She said, "I love you," as if it were a secret, and an immense one. His dad stood up and stepped toward him. "Catherine called my cell," he said. She's worried about you. Colin felt his dad's hand on his shoulder, and then they both moved forward, and then they were hugging.
We're very concerned, his mom said.
She was a small woman with curly brown hair that had one single shock of white toward the front.
And stunned, she added. What happened?
I don't know, Colin said softly into his dad's shoulder. She'd had enough of me. She got tired, that's what she said. And then his mom got up, and there was a lot of hugging, arms everywhere, and his mom was crying. Colin extricated himself from the hugs and sat down on his bed. He felt a tremendous need to get them out of his room immediately, like if they didn't leave, he would blow up. Literally, guts on the walls, his prodigious brain emptied out onto his bedspread.
Well, at some point we need to sit down and assess your options, his dad said.
His dad was big on assessing.
Not to look for silver linings, but it seems like you'll now have some free time this summer. A summer class at Northwestern, maybe?
I really need to be alone, just for today, Colin answered, trying to convey a sense of calm so that they would leave and he wouldn't blow up. So, can we assess tomorrow?
Of course, sweetie, his mom said. We'll be here all day. You just come down whenever you want, and we love you, and you're so, so special, Colin, and you can't possibly let this girl make you think otherwise, because you are the most magnificent, brilliant boy. And right then, the most special, magnificent, brilliant boy bolted into his bathroom and puked his guts out.
An explosion, sort of.
Oh, Colin, shouted his mom.
I just need to be alone, Colin insisted from the bathroom. Please.
When he came out, they were gone. For the next 14 hours, without pausing to eat or drink or throw up again, Colin read and reread his yearbook, which he had received just 4 days before. Aside from the usual yearbook crap, it contained 72 signatures. 12 were just signatures, 56 cited his intelligence, 25 said they wished they'd known him better, 11 said it was fun to have him in English class, 7 included the words pupillary sphincter, more on that later, and a stunning 17 ended, stay cool. Colin Singleton could no more stay cool than a blue whale could stay skinny, or Bangladesh could stay rich. Presumably, those 17 people were kidding. He mulled this over and considered how 25 of his classmates, some of whom he'd been attending school with for 12 years, could possibly have wanted to know him better, as if they hadn't had a chance. But mostly, for those 14 hours, he read and reread Catherine the 19th's inscription.
Call, here's to all the places we went and all the places we'll go, and here's me, whispering again and again and again and again, I love you. YRS forever, KATHERINE.
Eventually, he found the bed too comfortable for his state of mind, so he lay down on his back, his legs sprawled across the carpet. He anagrammed YRS forever until he found one he liked. Sorry Fever. And then he lay there in his fever of sorry, and repeated the now memorized note in his head, and wanted to cry, but instead he only felt this aching behind his solar plexus. Crying adds something. Crying is you plus tears. But the feeling Colin had was some horrible opposite of crying. It was you minus something. He kept thinking about one word, forever, and felt the burning ache just beneath his ribcage. It hurt like the worst ass-kicking he'd ever gotten. And he'd gotten plenty. Chapter 2. It hurt like this until shortly before 10 p.m., when a rather fat, hirsute guy of Lebanese descent burst into Colin's room without knocking. Colin turned his head and squinted up at him.
"What the hell is this?"
asked Hassan, almost shouting.
"She dumped me," answered Colin. "So I heard." "Listen, Sitzbinkler, I'd love to comfort you, but I could put out a house fire with the contents of my bladder right now."
Sitzpinkler is a German word, slang for wimp, that literally means a man who sits to pee. Those wacky Germans, they've got a word for everything. Hassan breezed past the bed and opened the door to the bathroom.
God, Singleton, what'd you eat? It smells like... Ah, puke! Puke! Eee!
And as Hassan screamed, Colin thought, oh, right, the toilet. Should have flushed.
Forgive me if I missed, Hassan said upon returning.
He sat down on the edge of the bed and softly kicked Colin's prostrate body.
I had to hold my nose with both fugging hands, so Thunderstick was swinging freely. A mighty pendulum, that fugger.
Colin didn't laugh.
God, you must be in some state, because A, Thunderstick jokes are my best material, and B, who forgets to flush their own hurl?
I just want to crawl into a hole and die. Colin spoke into the cream carpet with no audible emotion.
Oh, boy, Hassan said, exhaling slowly.
All I ever wanted was for her to love me and to do something meaningful with my life. And look.
I mean, look, he said. I am looking. And I'll grant you, kafir.
Kafir is a not-nice Arabic word meaning non-Muslim that is usually translated as infidel.
That I don't like what I'm seeing, or what I'm smelling, for that matter.
Hassan lay back on the bed and let Colin's misery hang in the air for a moment.
I'm just a failure. What if this is it? What if 10 years from now I'm sitting in a fucking cubicle crunching numbers and memorizing baseball statistics so I can kick ass in my fantasy league and I don't have her and I never do anything significant and I'm just a complete waste?
Hassan sat up, his hands on his knees.
See, this is why you need to believe in God. Because I don't even expect to have a cube, and I'm happier than a pig in a pile of shit.
Colin sighed. Although Hassan himself was not that religious, he often jokingly tried to convert Colin. Right. Faith in God, that's a good idea. I'd also like to believe that I could fly into outer space on the fluffy backs of gigantic penguins and screw Catherine the 19th in zero gravity.
Singleton, you need to believe in God worse than anyone I ever met.
Well, you need to go to college, Colin muttered. Hassan groaned. A year ahead of Colin in school, Hassan had taken a year off, even though he'd been admitted to Loyola University in Chicago. Since he hadn't enrolled in classes for the coming fall, it seemed his 1 year off would soon turn into two.
Don't make this about me, Hassan said through a smile. I'm not the one who's too fugged up to get off the carpet or flush my own puke, dude. And you know why? I got me some God.
Stop trying to convert me, Colin moaned, unamused. Hassan jumped up and straddled Colin on the floor and pinned his arms down and started shouting,
There is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Say it with me, Sitzpinkler. La ilah illa Allah.
This is the Islamic statement of faith. In transliterated Arabic, there is no God but God. Colin started laughing breathlessly beneath Hassan's weight, and Hassan laughed too.
I'm trying to save your sorry ass from hell. Get off, or I'm going there quite soon, Colin wheezed.
Hassan stood up and abruptly moved to serious mode.
So what's the problem exactly?
The problem exactly is that she dumped me, that I'm alone. Oh my God, I'm alone again. And not only that, but I'm a total failure in case you haven't noticed. I'm washed up. I'm former. Formerly the boyfriend of Catherine the 19th. Formerly a prodigy. Formerly full of potential. Currently full of shit. As Colin had explained to Hassan countless times, there's a stark difference between the words prodigy and genius. Prodigies can very quickly learn what other people have already figured out. Geniuses discover that which no one has ever previously discovered. Prodigies learn, geniuses do. The vast majority of child prodigies don't become adult geniuses. Colin was almost certain that he was among that unfortunate majority. Hassan sat down on the bed and tugged at his stubbly second chin.
Is the real problem here the genius thing or the Catherine thing?
I just love her so much, was Colin's answer. But the truth was that in Colin's mind, the problems were related. The problem was that this most special, magnificent, brilliant boy was, well, not. The problem itself was that he didn't matter. Colin Singleton, noted child prodigy, noted veteran of Catherine conflicts, noted nerd and sitzpinkler, didn't matter to Catherine the 19th, and he didn't matter to the world. All of a sudden, he wasn't anyone's boyfriend or anyone's genius. And that, to use the kind of complex word you'd expect from a prodigy, blew.
Because the genius thing, Hassan went on, as if Colin hadn't just professed his love, is nothing. That's just about wanting to be famous.
No, it's not. I want to matter, he said.
Right, like I said, you want fame. Famous is the new popular. And you're not going to be America's fucking next top model. That's for goddamn sure. So you want to be America's next top genius, and now you're, and don't take this personally, whining that it hasn't happened yet.
You're not helping, Colin muttered into the carpet. Colin turned his face to look up at Hassan.
Get up,
Hassan said, reaching a hand down. Colin grabbed it, pulled himself up, and then tried to let go of Hassan's hand, but Hassan gripped tighter.
Kafir, you have a very complicated problem with a very simple solution.
Chapter 3
A road trip, Colin said. He had an overstuffed duffel bag at his feet and a backpack stretched taut, which contained only books. He and Hassan were sitting on a black leather couch. Colin's parents sat across from them on an identical couch. Colin's mother shook her head rhythmically like a disapproving metronome.
To where? She asked. And why?
No offense, Mrs. Singleton, Hassan said, putting his feet up on the coffee table, which you were not allowed to do, but you're sort of missing the point. There is no where or why.
Think of all you could do this summer, Colin.
You could learn Sanskrit, said his dad. I know how you've been wanting to learn Sanskrit.
Which, pathetically enough, was true. Colin really had been wanting to learn Sanskrit. It's sort of the Mount Everest of dead languages.
Will you really be happy just driving around aimlessly? That doesn't seem like you. Frankly, it seems like quitting.
Quitting what, Dad? His dad paused. He always paused after a question, and then when he did speak, it was in complete sentences, without ums or likes or uhs, as if he'd memorized his response.
It pains me to say this, Colin, but if you wish to continue to grow intellectually, you need to work harder right now than you ever have before. Otherwise, you risk wasting your potential.
Technically, Colin answered, I think I might have already wasted it.
Maybe it was because Colin had never once in his life disappointed his parents. He did not drink or do drugs or smoke cigarettes or wear black eyeliner or stay out late or get bad grades or pierce his tongue or have the words Catherine Lova for Life tattooed across his back. Or maybe they felt guilty, like somehow they'd failed him and brought him to this place. Or maybe they just wanted a few weeks alone to rekindle the romance. But 5 minutes after acknowledging his wasted potential, Colin Singleton was behind the wheel of his lengthy gray Oldsmobile, known as Satan's hearse. Inside the car, Hassan said,
Okay, now all we have to do is go to my house, pick up some clothes, and miraculously convince my parents to let me go on a road trip.
You could say you have a summer job at, like, a camp or something, Colin offered.
Right, except I'm not gonna lie to my mom. Because what kind of bastard lies to his own mother? Well, although someone else could lie to her, I could live with that.
Fine, said Colin. 5 minutes later, they double-parked on a street in Chicago's Ravenswood neighborhood and jumped out of the car together. Hassan burst into the house with Colin trailing. In the well-appointed living room, Hassan's mom sat in an easy chair, sleeping.
Hey, Mama, said Hassan, wake up.
She jolted awake, smiled, and greeted both of the boys in Arabic. Colin answered in Arabic, saying,
My girlfriend dumped me, and I'm really depressed, and so Hassan and I are going to go on a vacation where you drive. I don't know the word in Arabic.
Mrs. Harbish shook her head and pursed her lips.
Don't I tell you, she said in accented English, not to mess with girls? Hassan is a good boy, doesn't do this dating. And look how happy he is. You should learn from him.
That's what he's going to teach me on this trip, Colin said, although nothing could have been further from the truth.
Hassan barreled back into the room, carrying a half-zip duffel bag, overflowing with clothes.
Ahobek, Mama,
which is Arabic for I love you, he said, leaning down to kiss her cheek. Suddenly, a pajama-clad Mr. Harbish entered the living room and in English said,
You're not going anywhere.
Oh, Dad, we have to. Look at him, he's all screwed up.
Colin stared up at Mr. Harbish and tried to look as screwed up as he possibly could.
He's going with or without me, but with me, at least I can watch out for him.
Colin is a good boy, Mrs. Harbish said to her husband.
I'll call you every day, Hassan added. We won't even be gone long, just until he gets better.
Colin, now completely improvising, had an idea.
I'm going to get Hassan a job, he said to Mr. Harbish. I think we both need to learn the value of hard work.
Mr. Harbish grunted in agreement, then turned to Hassan.
You need to learn the value of not watching that awful Judge Judy for starters. If you call me in a week and have a job, you can stay wherever you want as long as you want, as far as I'm concerned.
Hassan seemed not to notice the insults, only meekly mumbling,
Thanks, Dad.
He kissed his mother on both cheeks and hurried out the door.
What a dick,
Hassan said once they were safely inside the hearse.
It's one thing to accuse me of laziness, but to malign the good name of America's greatest television judge, that's below the belt.
Hassan fell asleep around 1 a.m, and Colin, half drunk on well-creamed gas station coffee and the exhilarating loneliness of a freeway in nighttime, drove south on I-65 through Indianapolis. It was a warm night for early June, and since the AC in Satan's hearse hadn't worked in this millennium, the windows were cracked open. And the beautiful thing about driving was that it stole just enough of his attention. Car parked on the side, maybe a cop, slow to speed limit. Time to pass this 16-wheeler. Turn signal. Check rear view. Crane neck to check blind spot. And yes, okay, left lane. To distract from the gnawing hole in his belly. To keep his mind occupied, he thought of other holes in other stomachs. He thought of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, assassinated in 1914. As he looked down at the bloody hole in his middle, the Archduke had said, It is nothing. He was mistaken. There's no doubt that the Archduke Franz Ferdinand mattered, although he was neither a prodigy nor a genius. His assassination sparked World War I, so his death led to 8,528,831 others. Colin missed her. Missing her kept him awake more than the coffee, and when Hassan had asked to drive an hour back, Colin had said no, because the driving kept him going. Stay under 70. God, my heart racing. I hate the taste of coffee. So wired, though. Okay, and clear of the truck. Okay, yes, right lane. And now just my own headlights against the darkness. It kept the loneliness of crushlessness from being entirely crushing. Driving was a kind of thinking, the only kind he could then tolerate. But still, the thought lurked out there, just beyond the reach of his headlights. He'd been dumped by a girl named Catherine for the 19th time. When it comes to girls, and in Colin's case it so often did, everyone has a type. Colin Singleton's type was not physical, but linguistic. He liked Catherine's, and not Katie's or Cat's or Kitty's or Kathy's or Rin's or Trina's or K's or Kate's or, God forbid, Catherine's with a C. K-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E. He had dated 19 girls. All of them had been named Catherine. And all of them, every single solitary one, had dumped him. Colin believed that the world contained exactly two kinds of people, dumpers and dumpees. A lot of people will claim to be both, but those people miss the point entirely. You are predisposed to either one fate or the other. Dumpers may not always be the heartbreakers, and the dumpees may not always be the heartbroken, but everyone has a tendency. It might be helpful to think about this graphically. Colin saw the dumper-dumpee dichotomy on a bell curve.
The majority of people are lumped somewhere in the middle, i.e. they're either slight dumpies or slight dumpers. But then you have your Catherines and your Collins. Catherine's on the extreme end of the dumper side, and Colin on the other end of the curve, the extreme dumpy. Perhaps, then, Colin ought to have grown accustomed to it, to the rise and fall of relationships. Dating, after all, only ends one way, poorly. If you think about it, and Colin often did, all romantic relationships end in either 1, breakup, 2, divorce, or 3, death. But Catherine the 19th had been different, or had seemed different anyway. She had loved him, and he had loved her back ferociously, and he still did. He found himself working the words through his mind as he drove. I love you, Catherine. The name sounded different in his mouth when spoken to her. It became not the name with which he had so long been obsessed, but a word that described only her, a word that smelled like lilacs, that captured the blue of her eyes and the length of her eyelashes. As the wind rushed in through the cracked windows, Colin thought of dumpers and dumpies and of the Archduke. In the back, Hassan grunted and sniffled as if he were dreaming he was a German shepherd, and Colin felt the ceaseless burning in his gut, thinking, this is all so childish, pathetic, you're embarrassing, get over it, get over it, get over it. But he did not quite know what it was. Catherine the First, the beginning of the beginning. Colin's parents never considered him to be anything but normal until one June morning. 25-month-old Colin sat in a high chair, eating a breakfast of indeterminate vegetative origin, while his father read the Chicago Tribune across their small kitchen table. Colin was skinny for his age, but tall, with tight brown curls that erupted from his head with an Einsteinian unpredictability.
3D Don West Side, Colin said after swallowing a bite. No want more greenies, he added, referring to his food.
What'd you say, bud?
3D Don West Side. I want French fries, please, thank you.
Like a smart monkey, Colin possessed an extensive vocabulary but very little grammar. Also, he didn't know D-E-A-D was pronounced dead. Forgive him, he was 2. Colin's dad flipped the paper around and stared at the large headline above the fold on the front page. This was Colin's first memory, his dad slowly lowering the paper and smiling at him. His dad's eyes were wide with surprise and pleasure, and his smile was uncontainable.
Cindy! The boy is reading the paper! He shouted.
His parents were the sort of parents who really, really enjoyed reading. His mom taught French at the prestigious and expensive Coleman School downtown, and his dad was a sociology professor at Northwestern University, just north of the city. So after 3 died on the West Side, Colin's parents began to read with him, everywhere and always, primarily in English, but also from French-language picture books. 4 months later, Colin's parents sent him to a preschool for gifted children. The preschool said that Colin was too advanced for their school, and anyway, they didn't accept children who weren't yet fully potty trained. They sent Colin to a psychologist at the University of Chicago. And so the periodically incontinent prodigy ended up in a small windowless office on the South Side, talking to a woman with horn-rimmed glasses, who asked Colin to find patterns in strings of letters and numbers. She asked him to flip polygons. She asked him which picture did not fit with the rest of the pictures. She asked him an endless string of wonderful questions, and Colin loved her for it. Up until that time, most of the questions Colin had been asked centered around whether or not he had pissed himself and whether he could please eat one more bite of the miserable greenies. After an hour of questions, the woman said, "I want to thank you for your extraordinary patience, Colin. You're a very special person. You're a very special person." Colin would hear this a lot, and yet, somehow, he could never hear it enough. The horn-rimmed glasses woman brought his mom into the office. As the professor told Mrs. Singleton that Colin was brilliant, was a very special boy, Colin played with wooden alphabet blocks. He gave himself a splinter, rearranging
POTS into STOP, the first anagram he remembered making. The professor told Mrs. Singleton that Colin's gifts must be encouraged but not pushed, and she warned, "You shouldn't have unreasonable expectations. Children like Colin process information very quickly. They show a remarkable ability to focus on tasks, but he's no more likely to win a Nobel Prize than any other reasonably intelligent child." That night, at home, his father brought him a new book, The Missing Piece by Shel Silverstein. Colin sat down on the couch beside his dad, and his small hands flipped through the big pages as he read it quickly, pausing only to ask whether lookin' was the same as looking. Colin emphatically pushed the book cover shut when he finished reading. "Did you like it?" his dad asked.
"Yep,"
Colin said. He liked all books because he liked the mere act of reading, the magic of turning scratches on a page into words inside his head.
"What was it about?" his dad asked.
Colin placed the book in his dad's lap and said,
"This circle is missing a piece. The missing piece is shaped like a pizza."
"Like a pizza or a pizza slice?"
Smiling, his dad placed his big hands on top of Colin's head.
"Right, Daddy, a slice. So the circle goes looking for his piece. He finds a lot of wrong pieces. Then he finds the right piece, but then he leaves it behind. Then it ends."
"Do you sometimes feel like a circle missing a piece?" his dad wondered.
"Daddy, I am not a circle. I am a boy."
And his dad's smile faded just a bit. The prodigy could read, but he could not see. And if only Colin had known that he was missing a piece, that his inability to see himself in the story of a circle was an unfixable problem, he might have known that the rest of the world would catch up with him as time passed. To borrow from another story he memorized but didn't really get, if only he'd known that the story of the tortoise and the hare is about more than a tortoise and a hare, he might have saved himself considerable trouble. 3 years later, he enrolled in first grade, for free because his mom taught there, at the Coleman School, merely 1 year younger than most of his classmates. His dad pushed him to study more and harder, but he wasn't the kind of prodigy who goes to college at 11. Both Colin's parents believed in keeping him on a semi-normal educational track for the sake of what they referred to as his sociological well-being. But his sociological being was never all that well. Colin didn't excel at making friends. He and his classmates just didn't enjoy similar activities. His favorite thing to do during recess, for instance, was to pretend to be a robot. He'd walk up to Robert Caseman with a knees-locked gait, his arms swinging stiffly. In a monotone voice, Colin would say, "I am a robot. I can answer any question. Do you want to know who the 14th president was?"
"Okay," said Robert. "My question is, why are you such a tard, colon cancer?"
Even though Colin's name was pronounced like call in, Robert Caseman's favorite game in first grade was calling Colin colon cancer until Colin cried, which usually didn't take very long because Colin was what his mother called sensitive. He just wanted to play robot, for God's sake. Was that so wrong? In second grade, Robert Caseman and his ilk matured a bit. Finally recognizing that words can never hurt, but sticks and stones can sure break bones, they invented the abdominal snowman, which, for the record, Colin actually named. The others called it the stretch. But then one time when they were about to do it to him, Colin shouted,
"Don't give me an abdominal snowman!"
And the name was so clever it stuck. They would order him to lie on the ground, and for some reason he'd agree. And then four guys would take a limb apiece and pull. It was a kind of drawing and quartering, but with seven-year-olds tugging, it wasn't fatal, just embarrassing and dumb. It made him feel like no one liked him, which, in fact, no one did. His single consolation was that one day he would matter. He'd be famous, and none of them ever would. That's why, his mom said, they made fun of him in the first place. "They're just jealous," she said, but Colin knew better. They weren't jealous. He just wasn't likable. Sometimes it's that simple. and so both Colin and his parents were utterly pleased and relieved when, just after the start of third grade, Colin Singleton proved his sociological well-being by, briefly, winning the heart of the prettiest 8-year-old girl in all Chicago. Chapter 4. Colin pulled into a rest stop near Paducah, Kentucky, around 3 a.m, leaned his seat back until it pressed against Hassan's legs in the back seat, and slept. Some 4 hours later, he awoke. Hassan was kicking him through the seat.
Kafir, I'm paralyzed back here. Lean that shit forward, I gotta pray.
He'd been dreaming his memories of Catherine. Colin reached down and pulled the lever, his seat snapping forward.
Ugh, Hassan said. Did something die in my throat last night?
I'm sleeping.
Because my mouth tastes like an open grave. Did you pack any toothpaste?
There's a word for that, actually. Foetor hepaticus. It happens during
not interesting, said Hassan,
which is what he said whenever Colin started going off on a random tangent.
Toothpaste?
Toiletry kit in the duffel in the trunk, Colin answered. But anyway, it's called foetor hepaticus, and it's a symptom of late-stage liver failure. Basically, what happens is that your breath literally smells like a rotting corpse. Hassan slammed the door behind him, then slammed the trunk shut a few moments later, and as Colin wiped the sleep from his eyes, he figured he might as well wake up. While Hassan knelt on the concrete outside, facing Mecca, Colin went to the bathroom. The graffiti in the stall read, "Call Dana for blow." Colin wondered whether Dana provided fellatio or cocaine. And then, for the first time since he'd been lying motionless on the carpet of his bedroom, he indulged his greatest passion. He anagrammed, "Call Dana for blow." Ballad for a clown. He walked out into the warmth of Kentucky and sat down at a picnic table across from Hassan, who seemed to be attacking the table with the pocket knife attached to his keychain. What are you doing? Colin folded his arms on the table and then put his head down.
Well, while you were in the bathroom, I sat down at this picnic table here in Bumblefug, Kentucky, and noticed that someone had carved that God hates fag, which, aside from being a grammatical nightmare, is absolutely ridiculous. So I'm changing it to God hates baguettes. It's tough to disagree with that. Everybody hates baguettes.
J'aime les baguettes, Colin muttered.
You am lots of stupid crap.
While Hassan worked to make God hates baguettes, Colin's mind raced like this. 1. Baguettes. 2. Catherine the 19th. 3. The ruby necklace he'd bought her 5 months and 17 days before. 4. Most rubies come from India, which, 5, used to be under control of the United Kingdom, of which, 6, Winston Churchill was the Prime Minister, and 7, isn't it interesting how a lot of good politicians, like Churchill and also Gandhi, were bald, while 8, a lot of evil dictators like Hitler and Stalin and Saddam Hussein were mustachioed? But 9, Mussolini only wore a mustache sometimes, and 10, lots of good scientists had mustaches, like the Italian Ruggero Oddi, who, 11, discovered and named for himself the intestinal tract's sphincter of Oddi, which is just one of several lesser-known sphincters like, 12, the pupillary sphincter. And speaking of which, when Hassan Harbish showed up at the Coleman School in 10th grade after a decade of homeschooling, he was plenty smart, albeit not prodigiously so. That fall, he was in Calculus 1 with Colin, who was a 9th grader. But they never spoke because Colin had given up on pursuing friendships with individuals not named Catherine. He hated almost all the students at Coleman, which was just as well since, by and large, they hated him back. About 2 weeks into class, Colin raised his hand and Ms. Sorenstein said, "Yes, Colin?" Colin was holding his hand underneath his glasses, against his left eye, in obvious discomfort.
"May I be excused for a moment?" he asked.
"Is it important?"
"I think I have an eyelash in my pupillary sphincter," replied Colin, and the class erupted into laughter.
Ms. Sorenstein sent him on his way, and then Colin went into the bathroom, and, staring in the mirror, plucked the eyelash from his eye, where the pupillary sphincter is located. After class, Hassan found Colin eating a peanut butter and no-jelly sandwich on the wide stone staircase at the school's back entrance.
"Look," Hassan said, This is my 9th day at a school in my entire life, and yet somehow I have already grasped what you can and cannot say. And you cannot say anything about your own sphincter. It's part of your eye, Colin said defensively. I was being clever. Listen, dude, you gotta know your audience. That bit would kill at an ophthalmologist convention, but in calculus class, everybody's just wondering how the hell you got an eyelash there.
And so they were friends.
I've got to say, I don't think much of Kentucky, Hassan said.
Colin tilted his head up, resting his chin on his arms. He scanned the rest stop parking lot for a moment. His missing piece was nowhere to be found.
Everything here reminds me of her, too. We used to talk about going to Paris. I mean, I don't even want to go to Paris, but I just keep imagining how excited she'd be at the Louvre. We'd go to great restaurants and maybe drink red wine. We even looked for hotels on the web. We could have done that on the Cranial Kid's money.
More on that later, but basically about a year before, Colin had come into some cash.
Dude, if Kentucky is going to remind you of Paris, we're in a hell of a pickle.
Colin sat up and looked across the poorly kept lawn of the rest stop. And then he looked down at Hassan's clever handiwork.
Baguettes, Colin explained.
Oh my God, give me the keys.
Colin reached into his pocket and tossed the keys lazily across the picnic table. Hassan snatched them as he stood, then made his way to Satan's hearse. Colin followed, forlorn. 40 miles down the road, still in Kentucky, Colin had curled up against the passenger window and was starting to fall asleep when Hassan announced,
"World's largest wooden crucifix, next exit."
"We're not stopping to see the world's largest wooden crucifix."
"We shit sure are," Hassan said. "It must be huge."
"Hass, why would we stop and see the world's largest wooden crucifix?"
"It's a road trip. It's about adventure."
Hassan pounded on the steering wheel to emphasize his excitement.
"It's not like we have somewhere to go. Do you really want to die having never seen the world's largest wooden crucifix?"
Colin thought it over. "Yes. First off, neither of us is Christian. Second off, spending the summer chasing after idiotic roadside attractions is not going to fix anything. Third off, crucifixes remind me of her."
"Of who?"
"Of her."
"Kafir, she was an atheist."
"Not always," Colin said softly. "She used to wear one a long time ago, before we dated." He stared out the window, pine trees rushing past. His immaculate memory called forth the silver crucifix.
"Your sitzpinkling disgusts me,"
Hassan said, but he gave the hearse some extra gas and shot past the exit. Chapter 5. 2 hours after passing the world's largest wooden crucifix, Hassan brought it back up.
"Did you already know that the world's largest wooden crucifix was in Kentucky?"
he shouted, his window down and his left hand waving through the fast-passing air.
"Not before today," Colin answered, "but I did know that the world's largest wooden church is in Finland." "Not interesting," Hassan said.
Hassan's "not interestings" had helped Colin figure out what other people did and did not enjoy hearing about. Colin had never gotten that before Hassan, because everyone else either humored or ignored him. Or, in the case of Catherine's, humored, then ignored. Thanks to Colin's collected list of things that weren't interesting, he could hold a halfway normal conversation. Among many, many others, the following things were definitely not interesting. The pupillary sphincter, mitosis, Baroque architecture, jokes that have physics equations as punchlines, the British monarchy, Russian grammar, and the significant role that salt has played in human history. 200 miles and one pit stop later, safely removed from Kentucky, they were midway between Nashville and Memphis. The wind through the open windows dried their sweat without actually cooling them much, and Colin was wondering how they could get to a place with air conditioning when he noticed the hand-painted billboard towering above a field of cotton or corn or soybeans or something, crop identification not being among Colin's talents. Exit 212. See the grave of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the corpse that started World War I.
That just doesn't seem plausible, Colin noted quietly. I'm just saying that I think we should go somewhere, Hassan said, not hearing him. I mean, I like this interstate as much as the next guy, but the farther south we go, the hotter it gets, and I'm already sweating like a whore in church.
Colin rubbed his sore neck, thinking he would never spend another night in the car when he had plenty of money to pay for hotels.
Did you see that sign? He asked. What sign?
The one about the grave of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. With little regard for the road, Hassan turned to Colin, smiled broadly, and punched him softly on the shoulder.
Excellent. Excellent! And anyway, it's lunchtime.
As Colin climbed out of the passenger's seat in the Hardee's parking lot at exit 212 in Carver County, Tennessee, he called his mom.
Hey, we're in Tennessee.
How are you feeling, buddy?
Better, I guess. I don't know. It's hot. Did anyone call?
His mom paused, and he could just feel her wretched pity.
Sorry, love. I'll tell, anyone to call your cell.
Thanks, Mom. I gotta go eat lunch at Hardee's.
Sounds delightful. Wear your seatbelt. I love you.
You too.
After a relentlessly greasy monster thick burger in the empty restaurant, Colin asked the woman behind the cash register, whose body seemed to have suffered from perhaps a few too many meals at her place of employment, how to get to Franz Ferdinand's grave.
Who?
She asked. The Archduke Franz Ferdinand. The woman stared at him blankly for a moment, and then her eyes lit up.
Oh, y'all are looking for Gutshot. Boy, you're headed for the sticks, aren't you?
Gutshot?
Yes. Now, what you want to do is, you pull out of the parking lot, and you turn right. Away from the highway, I mean. And then, in about 2 miles, that road's going to tee. There's a closed-down sit-go there. You take a right onto that road, and then you're going to drive past a whole lot of nothing for 10 or 15 miles. You'll go up a bit of a hill, and then that's Gutshot.
Gutshot?
Gutshot, Tennessee. That's where they got the Archduke.
So, a right and then a right.
Yep. Y'all have fun now, you hear?
Gutshot, Colin repeated to himself.
Okay. Thanks.
Since its last paving, the 10 or 15 mile long road in question seemed to have been at the epicenter of an earthquake. Colin drove cautiously, but still, the worn shocks of the hearse creaked and groaned at the endless potholes and waving undulations of pavement.
Maybe we don't need to see the Archduke, said Hassan. We're on a road trip. It's about adventure, Colin mimicked. Do you think the people of Gutshot, Tennessee, have ever seen an actual living Arab? Oh, don't be so paranoid. Or, for that matter, do you think they've ever seen a Jufro?
Colin thought that over for a moment, and then said, Well, the woman at Hardee's was nice to us.
Right, but the woman at Hardee's called Gutshot the Sticks, Hassan said. I mean, if Hardee's is urban, I'm not sure I want to see rural.
Hassan rolled on with his diatribe, and Colin laughed and smiled at all the right places, but he just kept driving, calculating the odds that the Archduke, who died in Sarajevo more than 90 years before, and who'd randomly popped into Colin's brain the previous night, would end up between Colin and wherever he was heading. It was irrational, and Colin hated thinking irrationally. But he couldn't help but wonder whether perhaps being in the presence of the Archduke might reveal something to Colin about his missing piece. But of course, the universe does not conspire to put you in one place rather than another, Colin knew. He thought of Democritus, who said, Everywhere, man blames nature and fate, yet his fate is mostly but the echo of his character and passions, his mistakes and weaknesses. And so it was not fate, but Colin Singleton's character and passions, his mistakes and weaknesses, that finally brought him to Gutshot, Tennessee, population 864, as the roadside sign read. At first, Gutshot looked like everything that came before it, only with a better paved road. On each side of the hearse, fields of squat, luminously green plants stretched out into a gray forever, broken up only by the occasional horse pasture, barn, or stand of trees. Eventually, Colin saw before him on the side of the road a 2-story cinder-block building painted a ghastly pink.
I think that's Gutshot, he said, nodding toward the building.
On the side of the building, a hand-painted sign read, the Kingdom of Gutshot, eternal resting place of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, ice-cold beer, soda, bait. Colin pulled into the store's gravel driveway. Unbuckling his seatbelt, he said to Hassan, "I wonder if they keep the Archduke with the soda or the bait." Hassan's deep laugh filled the car.
"Shit, Colin made a funny. This place is like magic for you. Shame about how we're gonna die here, though. I mean, seriously, an Arab and a half-Jew enter a store in Tennessee. It's the beginning of a joke, and the punchline is sodomy."
Nonetheless, Colin heard Hassan shuffling his feet on the gravel parking lot behind him. They walked through a screened door into the Gutshot General Store. From behind the counter, a girl with a long, straight nose and brown eyes the size of some lesser planets looked up from an issue of Celebrity Living magazine and said, "How y'all doing?"
"We're okay. Yourself?"
Hassan asked, while Colin was trying to think whether a worthwhile soul in all of human history had ever read a single copy of Celebrity Living. To put it Venn diagrammatically, Colin would have argued that the world looked like this. One circle, consisting of the set of interesting people, touching but not intersecting another circle comprising the set of Celebrity Living people.
"Just fine," said the girl.
For a while, they walked around the store, pacing the dusty varnished 2x4s that comprised a floor, pretending to consider various snacks, drinks, and minnows swimming in bait tanks. Half crouched behind a chest-high rack of potato chips, Colin tugged on Hassan's t-shirt, cupped his hand over Hassan's ear, and whispered,
"Talk to her."
Except, in point of fact, Colin did not whisper, because he had never quite mastered the art of whispering. He just sort of talked in a slightly softer voice directly into Hassan's eardrum. Hassan winced and shook his head.
"What's the total area in square miles of the state of Kansas?"
he whispered.
Around 82,200. Why? "I just find it amusing that you know that, but can't figure out a way to speak without using your vocal cords."
Colin started to explain that even whispering involves the use of the vocal cords, but Hassan just rolled his eyes. So Colin brought his hand to his face and nibbled on the inside of his thumb while staring at Hassan hopefully. But Hass turned his attention to the potato chips, and so finally it fell to Colin. He walked to the desk and said,
"Hi, we're wondering about the Archduke."
The Celebrity Living reader smiled at him. Her puffy cheeks and too long nose disappeared. She had the sort of broad and guileful smile in which you couldn't help but believe. You just wanted to make her happy so you could keep seeing it. But it passed in a flash.
"Tours start every hour on the hour, cost $11, and frankly aren't worth it," she answered in a monotone.
"We'll pay," Hassan said suddenly behind him. "The kid needs to see the Archduke."
And then Hassan leaned forward and stage whispered,
"He's having a nervous breakdown."
Hassan placed $22 on the counter, which the girl promptly slid into a pocket of her shorts, flagrantly disregarding the cash register before her. The girl blew a lock of mahogany hair from her face and sighed.
"Sure is hot out," she noted.
"Is this like a guided tour?" Colin asked.
"Yeah, and much to my ever-loving chagrin, I am your tour guide."
She stepped out from behind the counter. Short, skinny. Her face not pretty so much as interesting-looking.
"I'm Colin Singleton," he said to the tour guide-slash-grocery-store clerk.
"Lindsay Lee Wells," she answered, reaching out a small hand, the fingernails a chipped metallic pink. He shook, and then Lindsay turned to Hassan.
"Hassan Harbish, Sunni Muslim, not a terrorist. Lindsay Lee Wells, Methodist, me neither."
The girl smiled again. Colin wasn't thinking about anything but himself and K-19 and the piece of his gut he'd misplaced, but there was no denying her smile. That smile could end wars and cure cancer. For a long time, they walked silently through knee-high grass behind the store, which irritated the sensitive skin of Colin's exposed calves, and he thought to mention it and ask whether maybe there was some kind of recently mowed patch through which they might walk, but he knew Hassan would think that sitzpinklery, so he stayed quiet as the grass tickled at his skin. He thought of Chicago, where you can go days without ever once stepping on a single patch of actual earth. That well-paved world appealed to him, and he missed it as his feet fell on uneven clumps of hardened dirt that threatened to twist his ankles. As Lindsay Lee Wells walked ahead of them, typical celebrity living reader crap avoiding talking to them, Hassan just padded along next to Colin, and even though he hadn't technically called Colin a sitzpinkler for being allergic to grass, Colin knew that he would have, which annoyed him. And so Colin again brought up Hassan's least favorite subject. "Have I mentioned today that you should go to college?" Colin asked. Hassan rolled his eyes.
"Right, I know. I mean, just look where academic excellence got you."
Colin couldn't think of a comeback.
"Well, but you should this year. You can't just not go forever. You don't even have to register until July 15th.
Colin had looked this up.
"I actually can not go forever. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I like sitting around on my ass, watching TV, and getting fatter. It's my life's work, Singleton. That's why I love road trips, dude. It's like doing something without actually doing anything. Anyway, my dad didn't go to college, and he's rich as balls."
Colin wondered just how rich balls were, but only said, "Right, but your dad doesn't sit on his ass either. He works like 100 hours a week."
"True, true, and it's all thanks to him that I don't have to go to work or college."
Colin had no response to that, but he just didn't get Hassan's apathy. What's the point of being alive if you don't at least try to do something remarkable? How very odd to believe God gave you your life and yet not think that life asks more of you than watching TV. Although, then again, when you've just gone on a road trip to escape the memory of your 19th Catherine and are traipsing through South Central Tennessee on your way to see the grave of a dead Austro-Hungarian Archduke, maybe you don't have a right to go and think anything odd. And he was busy anagramming anything odd. Any odd night. Handy dog tin. Doing thy DNA. When Colin did his DNA proud, he stumbled on a molehill and fell. He became so disoriented by the fast approaching ground that he didn't even reach his hands out to break the fall. He just fell forward like he'd been shot in the back. The very first thing to hit the ground were his glasses. They were followed closely by his forehead, which hit a small, jagged rock. Colin rolled over onto his back.
"I fell," he noted quite loudly.
"Shit," Hassan shouted, and when Colin opened his eyes, he saw fuzzily that Hassan and Lindsay Lee Wells were kneeling, peering down at him.
She smelled strongly of a fruity perfume, which Colin believed to be called Curve. He had purchased it once for Catherine the 17th, but she hadn't liked it.
"It smells like I rubbed chewed raspberry bubblicious on my neck," she said, but it didn't exactly. It smelled like raspberry bubblicious flavored perfume, which actually smelled very good.
"I'm bleeding, aren't I?" Colin asked.
"Like a stuck pig," she said. "Don't move."
She turned to Hassan and said, "Give me your t-shirt."
And Hassan promptly said no, which Colin figured had something to do with Hassan's man boobs.
"We need to apply pressure," Lindsay explained to Hassan. And then Hassan calmly said no again. And then Lindsay said, "Jesus Christ, fine," and took off her shirt.
Colin squinted through his glasses-less fuzziness, but couldn't see much.
"We should probably save this for the second date," Colin said.
"Right, perv," she responded, but he could hear her smiling.
As she wiped at his forehead and cheek softly with the t-shirt, then pressed hard on a tender spot above his right eyebrow, she kept talking.
"Some friend you've got, by the way. Stop moving your neck. The two concerns we've got here are some kind of vertebral injury or a subdural hematoma. I mean, slight chances, but you've got to be cautious, because the nearest hospital's an hour away."
He closed his eyes and tried not to wince as she pressed hard against the cut. Lindsay told Hassan,
"Apply pressure with the shirt here. I'll be back in 8 minutes.
"We should call a doctor or something," Hassan said.
"I'm a paramedic," Lindsay answered as she turned away.
"How the hell old are you?" he asked.
17. "Okay, fine, a paramedic in training. 8 minutes, I swear."
She ran off. It was not the way Curve smelled that Colin liked, not exactly. It was the way the air smelled just as Lindsay began to jog away from him. The smell the perfume left behind.